Welcome. It's interesting. We're starting out 2022 almost as disrupted as 2021 started, with just as much uncertainty. I think our complex world continues and our ability to deal with complexity hasn't waned over the holidays, and we're going to have to get even better at that as we move forward. Eager to talk more with our guest today about complexity. I want to get into our conversation. So Deborah, would you introduce our guest today and let's get started?
I'd be happy to. Professor Eve Middleton Kelly. We met over 25 years ago and sat down over lunch and had the most fascinating conversation that so energized me and got me thinking in so many different directions. And she would hold these complexity conferences, and there'd be everything from academics to scientists to engineers to business people talking about these amazing projects that they were working on. There'd be an artist over in the corner making these drawings, trying to put all the ideas together. And there was just always so much going on in so many different directions. And she's really helped me to begin to get an understanding of the complexity approach. And what I love about her work is that it's so practical, because she's gone into corporations and worked with them around these ideas. So I thought it would be really interesting for us to hear from someone who straddles the academic and practical, you know, solving business problems, to, you know, hear what she has to tell us about how she's been doing that. Eve, thank you so much for making time in your very busy schedule to join us, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Deborah.
Nice to see you. So I think one of the things that we might want to set out first is, how do you view complexity, and what's brought you to bring all these disciplines in? I think we have to set the stage and then we can dig in a little bit more.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background. I was at the London School of Economics, which was my second career. My first career was in the British Civil Service. In my last years there, I was negotiating European directives. But when I joined the LSE and I started doing a PhD in information systems, and I decided to look at the alignment between the business and the IT community, and I sent off 100 letters to the CEOs and presidents and chairmen of the, believe it or not, the FTSE 100, and expecting, you know, you send 100 letters, you're lucky if you get 6 responses. I got a 60% response. It was unbelievable. It must have been the right time to ask the right question, because they really were very, very concerned about that lack of alignment. So I spent 2 years interviewing the most interesting people you can imagine. And at the end of it, I sat down and I thought, okay, what have I got that's new, that has not been thought of before? And the answer was nothing. It was incredibly depressing to find that after 2 years of talking to incredibly interesting people, my findings were nothing new. So anyway, in that state of depression, I was sent a paper that applied not yet complexity, but chaos theory to business. I read it right through. I disagreed with the conclusion, but the ideas it presented were so exciting. I mean, we hear of the light bulb moment. That was it for me. It was suddenly seeing things from a completely different perspective. And after that, I decided I need to find out more. So I read a great deal. And at the time, there was very little that was applied to organizations. It was biology, it was physics, it was mathematics, and so on. So I had to actually read all these original texts, try to make sense of them, and go to as many talks. I spent a lot of time in the US, especially the Santa Fe Institute, which is the center of complexity research, to try and understand. And from the very beginning, I decided I needed to understand how these concepts apply to social systems, not using metaphors, but how do they apply? What does it mean to be a self-organized unit, a team, an organization? What does it mean to explore the space of possibilities? I wanted to really find out. We spent 2 years, believe it or not, 2 years doing a project looking at co-evolution and what does it mean in a social context. And as Deborah said, one of the strengths of the time was I had set up a series of talks and seminars and so on. We invited the scientists, we invited the social scientists, et cetera, to all together try to understand what do these concepts mean in practice. And it was quite astonishing. So that's how it got started. And then people became very interested. They actually invited me to go and study the organizations. And then once that was established, once I started writing, my very first paper got an award and so on. And then the research councils who give us our funding actually invited me to put in for funding. It was unheard of. I was very fortunate. It was just the right time and the right idea. So long answer, but you needed to understand the context of it.
That's really helpful, Eve.
Great. Eve, I'd love to know a little bit more about your complexity methodology, intersection of the research and consulting piece. And people here are coaches and consultants, so they will have absolutely some knowledge around complexity, you know, models such as Kinefin and frameworks such as polarity mapping and these kinds of concepts. But what's amazing to me about your methodology is it's so wide-ranging, this qualitative and quantitative piece. And I wonder if you could give us a sort of flavor of the breadth of your framework, your methodology.
Okay. Again, a little bit more context. This methodology emerged from practical work. It was not something that I sat down and said, tomorrow I'm going to develop a methodology. It evolved over a number of years by looking at very practical, very difficult, very complex challenges. So everything from management challenges within an organization to things like deforestation. We did a project for the UN looking at fishing communities around the world. That was fascinating because the UN had this very limited idea which said that the small fishing communities around the world, it was to do with decision making and the fishing communities, because it was to do with how they develop, how the UN develops policy. And the idea they had was that the man is the fisherman, and therefore he's the major decision maker, full stop. It was so simplistic, it took my breath away. And to begin with, they said, can you do a desk research for us? In other words, look at what everybody else had done and report back. I said, no, sorry, I'm not interested. It's too boring. I either do original research or I'm not interested. And they decided, they upped the budget, they upped the time. And we actually talk to communities literally around the world. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Even in the communities where the man is the fisherman who is the main decision maker, once the fish have landed, it's the women who actually will clean the fish, will sell the fish, will repair the nets, will make all the major decisions in the home because the man is always at sea. And they are the ones that actually hold the community together. We looked at communities that were matriarchal, the exact opposite. We looked at other communities where there was a greater balance. And that was the richness of it, simply had never occurred to the UN. And it was quite astonishing. They loved the report. They completely changed their policy. So that was one example. A lot of other examples. We worked with, for example, Rolls-Royce Marine. Now, I don't know how many of you know, you probably know of Rolls-Royce, and that is no longer in cars, but in aerospace. But Rolls-Royce Marine, they wanted to expand into the marine industry to develop engines for shipping and so on. And instead of developing that market, they actually bought, it was a merger or rather an acquisition of a set of small family companies that were very, very good, had already gone through a set of mergers and acquisitions. They were all in the Nordic countries. And they simply acquired them. 2 years after they acquired them, they had huge problems during those 2 years. They simply could not understand each other. They would go to meetings, and the Swedes, the Norwegians, and the Finnish were different from each other and definitely different from the British. And therefore, the conclusion was, it is national cultural differences. That was it. And this was one of our big insights, because that was a fundamental error. They assigned one cause to a very complex problem. And that was one of the things we actually found, that it is not just national cultures, it is also, these complex problems are multidimensional. And this is at the heart of the methodology. The fact that complex problems are social, cultural, political, economic, physical, technical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To actually reduce it to a single cause, to linearity, A causes B, is a travesty. And unfortunately, we keep making that mistake time and time again. Our brains want to understand a simple relationship. And therefore, we jump far too quickly to the obvious conclusion. So one of the things we learned was, you've got to understand the complex problem space. If you don't spend time and effort understanding the nature of the problem, the nature of the challenge, you will never ever address it effectively. So what we did was, we, at the time, Rolls-Royce was just one of our research partners in a very, very large research project. And all I had at my disposal was the half time of one researcher. So the sponsor of the project in Rolls-Royce Marine said, would you like some help? We've got the advanced leadership team that may actually be able to help. So we made a presentation. Believe it or not, 16 of these very, very bright young people volunteered to become researchers. We trained them. So we did a lot of interviews around the world. And then we came together to do the analysis. So the first idea is in-depth analysis of the problem space. When we did do that in-depth analysis, we took several days over the analysis. And then eventually we came to a set of recommendations. That was one of the things they insisted. I don't usually like to give recommendations too early, but they insisted. We gave them a set of 12 recommendations. Believe it or not, every single one was adopted. After we finished the project, several years later, when I was using it as a case study, I went to their website to look at their financial record, and it was astonishing. You could see the profit and income rising all the time after the project, when it was very low before that, because they understood that the problem was not only national cultures. Yes, that was a very strong contributing factor, but there were a lot of other things that were contributing to it. And I'll give you one example. Aerospace and marine are very different in their markets. Aerospace has very few, very, very large customers. They're the airlines. Shipping, marine, has hundreds of thousands of small customers around the world. And the managing directors of these small companies used to spend half the year traveling around the world to get to know their customers intimately. The other difference was that To design a new engine can take as long as 20 years from the initial idea. To design or develop a new engine for shipping or change it could be very, very short indeed. In fact, very often you could sign the contract by the end of the week after the original request. So you have totally different time horizons, totally different market, but the thinking was so stuck into the aerospace framework that the Derby headquarters kept imposing those kinds of restrictions to these small family companies, and simply not understanding that they are fundamentally different. So that was another very strong contributing factor in having that lack of communication, that lack of understanding. And one small example, they imposed a matrix structure on those small family companies. I mean, you just have to think about it a little to realize that this is ridiculous, it's ludicrous, it cannot work. So eventually, what we came to understand was, first of all, as I said, the problem space is multidimensional. You need to understand not only the multiple dimensions, but also ask what happens when I make an intervention in one. If I change the cultural aspect, if I change the financial aspect, if I change the physical dimension, what is the impact? What are the consequences on all the other dimensions? And that was another deep insight. The fact that you cannot make a change in one dimension, because it cannot be isolated, it will have impact. So that's another thing I would suggest you always look at. What are the impacts, the consequences of making a particular, how can you look at the organization or the problem space as a whole, rather than try to look at it linearly as A causes B? So that was another deep insight that we gained from a lot of our research.
A question for you. You mentioned something a little bit ago that I think is important, and you're getting back to it here at the end of this piece with, you've got to look at it as a whole, as a complex situation. Given people's instinct to want to have binary, very simple kinds of answers, what's the best way to support leaders in realizing it's not a simple yes, no, but a more complex basket of things to sort through? What have you found is the best way to get people to pay attention to all of those elements?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important for them to appreciate the complexity of the challenge and to realize that you will not be able to address it in a simple way. And all you have to do is ask them, what have they done in the past? What have they tried out? What was their result? And in every single case, you will find that because they were using inappropriate approaches, thinking in the wrong way, they simply could not address it. And it is when it hurts enough, they are then prepared to listen. But the other thing is developing a partnership and listening as well as talking. It was having that discussion all the time with people across the different levels of the organization. It is not a matter of just going in as a consultant, doing some magic and coming back with recommendations. No, we had to develop that partnership. We had to develop relationships with the organization, with the board, and so on. So that was one of the ways of actually trying to bridge that big gap.
Hi, Eve and everyone. I'm just wondering, how long will you say that those relationships took to actually get all the nitty-gritty within, like to understand the relationship between yourself and all the parties within the organization? like in regards to time frame?
If it's intensive, if you're with them all day for several days, it doesn't take that long, but it can be, it's very intensive. And it's also, as I said, it's a lot of listening and then bringing up the ideas and discussing them in groups so that people have the opportunity to constantly ask questions, to say, okay, that applies in my particular unit, but not in that other one. What's the difference? How can we do it differently? So it's that constant interaction, that constant discussion. So it needn't take months or years. It can take, it can be quite short. It depends how much, how intensive it is and how much effort you put into it. It's not the thing that would take year.
Eve, one of the questions, it's about this relationship with systems theory and Peter Senge. So, and I know that you've had some connection there. So Carol.
Eve, thank you for sharing your research and your consulting. It sounds like you are primarily a consultant and researcher.
Okay, I would never call myself a consultant. The relationship with the companies was research partners. So they were there to help do the research. So it never a consultant. No, not in that way.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. I'm hearing the way you interact within the system, and it sounds very much like organization development and influenced by Peter Senge's work. And I guess as I think about many of us here are coaches, you just started to offer some questions. Sometimes it's around helping the leader ask good questions. So I'm wondering if you can offer to us some good questions that may help coaches help leaders.
There are some fundamental questions that are very, very important. One is why? Why did it happen in that particular way? Secondly, what do we need to do differently in order to achieve our objective when things keep going wrong? And constantly experimenting. So it is those questions that the leader needs to ask himself, herself, and also ask the team around them and the rest of the organization. You need to change the way of thinking. That's the key. It is not giving them how-tos only. It is changing the way they think about their challenges, because that way they will continue to be able to address those challenges. So asking these fundamental questions, always the why, always, you know, what could be done different? How do we learn from these ideas? How do we constantly create the environment where we can experiment in a safe way? And how do we learn from those experiments? How do we learn from success? How do we learn from failure? We learn from success not by copying best practice. I'm afraid that never works. And listen to what I'm saying, copying best practice. If you copy the how and put it in a different context, I can guarantee it will not work. If you understand why did it work in that context and then apply the underlying principle to the new context, it will work. And then when you've got a failure, very often failures are apparent or short-term. The idea is, what do we need to do differently? You keep on evolving the idea and changing it and trying to get to that deeper understanding. So my advice to leaders would be twofold. One is ask those fundamental questions, but secondly, stop thinking about solutions. Solutions only work under a certain set of circumstances. What you need to start thinking about is what we call an enabling environment. You have to co-create the environment that will make it possible for your team, for your people to experiment, to do things differently, to co-create a different way of working. That would be my greatest gift to them.
Eve, I wanted to pick up on something that you've said about, you know, the role of creativity in exploring the space of possibility. And I'd love you to say some more about the role of using artists to help deepen the understanding and the exploration.
That was, again, one of those wonderful, lucky coincidences. We were one of the first to have a resident artist before the term actually was identified. He would sit with us, with the research team, while we did the analysis and draw, just draw. What we found was that the brain can take in a complex picture much more readily than it can text. So you give someone a very well-written report or explain it, give them a presentation, it will take a lot longer than actually looking at a picture and discussing that. The power of the visual is very, very strong. And therefore, we can capture disparate ideas in one picture. And we explore that more and more and more. So for example, we had one organization that we find was totally dysfunctional. Now, you cannot stand up and say to the CEO and his board, your organization is totally dysfunctional, sorry. We put up a big picture on the wall while we were having coffee. We said nothing about it. It was just up there, actually describing that dysfunctionality. It was very odd. First of all, there was icy silence once, you know, they started realizing what the picture represented. And then someone laughed, it broke the ice, and we were able to talk about it. So that the power of, I mean, we would never have got so quickly to that state of being able to open and discuss honestly without that picture. So we found art very, very powerful and very useful.
Wonderful, thank you. Regina and a couple of other people are quite interested in whether you use the Kinefin framework within your methodology, some of the language you've used about best practice and complicated and complex, it seems to map with that.
I do not use the framework. I think what happened is many of us started at approximately the same time from approximately the same base and went and developed our own ideas. I'm afraid I only use my own original research. So yes, of course, we would have a huge overlap in terms of the language, in terms of the concepts and so on. But no, I do not use the Kinefin framework, even though I appreciate its value. I know an awful lot of people use it because, again, it's a picture and it expresses very powerfully the differences between complicated, complex, and so on. But I have an additional distinction between complicated and complex, if I may give you that distinction, because I think it's important. To me, complicated is something which we can design, we can predict its behavior, and we can control its behavior. We can do none of these things with a complex system. So we can design, for example, a traffic light system. Once you add the drivers, it becomes a complex socio-technical system, and you cannot design, control, or predict the behavior of the drivers. You can predict patterns of behavior, but you can never, ever predict specific point behavior at a particular time. And we need to keep that, you know, the distinction between the two, because very often we make the mistake of applying ideas from a machine-type complicated system to a complex one. And this is where some fundamental errors come in.
You have developed the EMK complexity methodology, which is your framework. What do we need to know about that? Obviously, we're going to read about that more afterwards, but what do we need to know about that framework ahead of that?
I have already mentioned the two fundamentals. One is understanding the deep problem space, and setting up a co-created enabling environment. These are the two key aspects of it. But the methodology itself is very, very rich. It will look at both present existing problems, but also look into the future. So I have worked with companies who wanted to make a fundamental change or to set up a different kind of company, and we would look into the future. So it uses a very large set. A methodology is a set of tools and methods, and you can use any tool or method as long as it looks at the problem holistically, as long as it takes into account the multidimensionality of the problem space. So we would bring in psychologists, we would bring in artists, we would bring in physicists, biologists, mathematicians, all of us working together and bringing in different tools and methods to understand the problem space. So the methodology itself, actually at the heart of it, is very simple. It is doing a lot of interviews in depth. Our interviews take 1.5 hours. They are not your quick 20-minute interviews, and constantly asking, you know, why, to understand in depth, an in-depth analysis of the material, and then working collaboratively with the problem owners to ask the question, what needs to be done to start co-creating the enabling environment? What's the framework that is needed? So it is based on in-depth work, in-depth analysis, and a lot of collaboration with the problem owner.
Eve, I'm curious to know how you manage to engage organizations that are very fast moving, fast paced, and need results yesterday, to engage in something that's obviously really valuable, but very in-depth and time consuming.
Because if they don't accept it, I will not work with them. I'm afraid I'm quite ruthless in terms of that. And if it hurts enough, they will do it. The other thing I think we need to understand is, when I work with organizations like Shell or whatever, there is no way that you can work with the make a change to the entire organization at the same time. It's not going to work. So what I try to explain is, let us work with one particular part, with one particular team. Let us experiment. Once that works, then that then ripples out. So you work with a particular group, a particular team that has a really, really difficult problem. And then when it starts working, everyone involved becomes the ambassadors, and they will spread out the word, and everyone else then wants to experiment and do it. So that is how you engage them. As I said, if it hurts enough, they will listen. If they don't listen, I'm not interested. And thirdly, do it with a small experiment. Don't try and change the entire organization at the same time. Once the small experiment works, then you can use all the other tools and methods to spread it throughout the rest of the organization. But you in the process, you also need to train their own people to use it, to change their thinking. A lot depends on thinking in a different way.
Eve, I'd love to hear some of your best tips on how to approach business planning in complex environments with like a senior leadership team. Like just business planning, you know, strategic planning. How do they approach it differently now? What would be your best tips?
Any kind of planning, again, cannot be linear. Whatever your plan is, there are different levels, different stages, different aspects to it. And at the highest level, you need to ask, what will be the impact of any changes? What do I want to achieve? How do I get there? But also, what are going to be the impacts at every stage, at every point? And the thing to remember is, you need to consider different scales. You need to think what needs to be done at an organizational level, what needs to be done at departmental level, what needs to be done at team level. They're not always identical, and therefore you need to think of those different scales and to, again, to co-create that environment at all those different scales where those involved with the problem feel enabled to actually try and out new ideas, to experiment. And so your planning has to be seen from a different perspective, to be seen as something which is living, which is evolving. You start with a document, but that document is not final, because as things evolve, as things change, you have to be able to make those changes, because there are always unexpected impacts, unexpected changes, and you need to be able to take those into account as you're going along. But also you need to be able to see them, you need to acknowledge them, you need to know that they're happening, and therefore your level of awareness has to be much, much sharper. So it's a totally different process of how do you plan. It's much more sort of hands-on, evolutionary. You need to be aware of the time. It demands an awful lot of leaders, but the results are outstanding, are out of all proportion.
Thank you, Eve.
Thank you, Eve. My question was about, I really love that, what needs to be done to start co-creating the enabling environment. And so I was wondering what the steps were after that. And then hearing you just talk, it seems like there's a piece around impact and then what needs to be done at scale. And so I was wondering if you ever arrive at like an agreed upon problem statement to start with as a living, you know, document that will get revisited and revised.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, what we will start with is when we have the analysis of the problem space. You cannot use that analysis raw because it paralyzes you. You suddenly realize it's impossible. We cannot deal with this mass of problems. So what we do is we work on what we call the co-evolutionary dynamics. In other words, if you were to make a change in the technical aspect, what will be the consequences? And then we bring together a cluster of issues that are closely related when you are making a particular change. And we have two or three of those clusters, okay? So this is your agreed initial step, your initial statement. You agree that these are some critical co-evolving dynamic clusters. And you start from there. So you don't try to address everything that you found, because it's impossible. But the point is, if you have some three or four clusters, believe it or not, they will actually include most of the ideas that's been discussed and identified, but they give you a practical way of starting. So you say, what do we need to address that particular cluster in all its dimensions? And that is very, very practical, very tangible. And that's how you get started.
Thank you, Eve. So I have a quick question. You mentioned that establishing a climate or a culture of experimentation versus solution is key. What specific things have you seen leaders do that supports that kind of environment? What are some of the action steps they can take to create that?
Are you asking how do you create the enabling environment or something more specific?
Yes, I'm asking the first question you just asked. How do you create that enabling environment? How do you fuel that?
Okay. First of all, it's co-create. It's never create. The top team will set some kind of framework, but they cannot do everything. And they need to understand that. The fact that their role is to create an environment, a framework, but then allow everyone else in the organization to develop the ideas, to take them forward. I'm genuinely talking about co-creation with the rest of the organization. Once you've understood what emergence means, what exploring the space of possibilities means, then you begin to get an understanding of, you cannot pre-design and predict what the final environment will look like. It will be something that evolves and changes. Yes, you have a framework, because the as I said, the top team needs to provide that framework, the budget, the physical space, etc., etc. And again, it comes down to opening it up to other levels in the organization. I worked with an organization in Helsinki, and the managers and the board were almost completely separate. And when we did the workshops and so on, they insisted in having them separately. And then when we did, they realized both levels that without each other, they cannot achieve the outcomes they desire. So part of the process that I help facilitate was for them to talk to each other and for the managers to involve their teams. It is that constant talking, communicating, explaining, understanding what really is the problem at different scales. And you cannot short circuit that, I'm afraid. And you cannot say, we've got these divisions. Okay, you've had the divisions. If you really want to change your organization, you need to think beyond divisions, and you need to find ways to open up those levels of communication. That's the key, really. Good communication.
Yeah, I love picking up on that. I had a similar question around leadership, and thank you so much for being here. This is fascinating. It's really, really got my mind spinning here. So considering at the leadership level, I'm really wondering in terms of what's the requirements, the mindset shifts that are necessary to embrace your framework or to embrace leading in chaos and complexity. So I'm imagining there are certain characteristics and assumptions and beliefs that leaders will have to acquire, adapt, include in order to go through this process. Because I'm imagining certain things pop to mind for me are things like patience, persistence, not moving to conclusion too quickly, learning to stay open. And I think that's challenging for leaders who are often looked to as, give us the answer. What do we do now? So I'm really curious about the leadership traits required to maneuver through what could be a very long and trying process.
Yes, it is. It is, absolutely. Okay, let me go a step back. One of the practical things we do is, first of all, explain the theory and the language. We start with the board, but then open it to everyone else in the organization. So they begin by having a shared language of these concepts. And again, this is a simple, practical thing to do. And then we ask those leaders to actually do some of the research themselves, to listen, to do some interviews, to do some analysis, and so on. And when they start doing that kind of firsthand interaction with people in the organization, and we recommend a cross section from the most junior to the most senior, they begin, or everything that you mentioned, no one will adapt that kind of behavior by someone else telling them. They have to experience it. They have to understand it. They have to come to that conclusion themselves. And I think that's fundamental, is how do you engage them practically in understanding their challenges? So it's actually almost sort of picking them up by the scruff of the neck and saying, do it. They may resent it to begin with, but I can assure you very, very, very quickly, they see the value of it and come back and say, thank you, that really was valuable. But again, you know, you have to be very, very understanding and use the kind of approach and language that they will not find offensive. You may asking them to be doing difficult things against what they may normally want to do. So you have to present it in a way that's acceptable to them. You really have to be a psychologist yourself to really get to understand how people will react to these ideas. Because once they start resisting, you've lost it.
I'm imagining even just the chaos within the leadership teams, right? Certain leaders believe this is what needs to happen, and others are saying that's what needs to happen. That's such a micro version of what you're trying to address at a macro level in the organization. So I imagine that would be an easy place to get turned over and sort of slowed down and locked down, or even fail at that, even at that fundamental level of getting the leaders on board. That's what I'm really trying to understand.
I'll give you an example. This exercise I was telling you about in Helsinki, we started the previous evening before the actual workshop. And I was sitting there, everyone introduced themselves, and then there was quite a discussion. And in fact, it turned into a very, very acrimonious argument between the CEO and one of his directors. And that went on. And after about 15 minutes, I said, okay, fine. If you wish to carry on with this argument, you don't need me. I can go back to my hotel. When you decide that I'm only here for 3 days. If you want the benefit of me being here, then let's get on with the exercise. They were so shocked at that, they stopped arguing. But the key was, once we started together to analyze the problem space, that was the key. They had to work together to understand the problem as a whole. And it was that working together that started to get them to work collaboratively and to actually understand that they can't carry on arguing between themselves. So you have to use very practical things to get them to be more collaborative.
As I listened and I heard words like emergence and possibilities, it sounds similar to a program that the organization I'm a part of has been using for 3 or 4 years, and that is design thinking from Stanford D School. Is that similar to what you're describing?
Yeah, design thinking shares a lot of the ideas, yes. In fact, one of the things that you need to know is I retired from the LSE and now I'm at Cambridge. And one of my Cambridge tutees, she's an engineer and actually used both frameworks in her dissertation. And the two work together brilliantly. So yes, I know of it. And there are a lot of similarities. Yes.
We've maybe got time for one more question.
In that case, I will answer the question you raised, Tracy. You said, what's the difference between systems theory and complexity theory? Systems theory articulated 4 of the basic principles: connectivity, interdependence, emergence, and feedback. All of those key principles were articulated by systems theory. These are the bricks, the ground on which complexity is based. You cannot build anything without connectivity, interdependence, emergence, and feedback. But then the complexity theory went on to identify things like exploring the space of possibilities, co-evolution, and so on. A lot more principles were developed that had systems theory as the base, but they enriched it. They developed it. We took it a huge step further. So the two are not identical, but they share that core of similar principles.
So helpful. Thank you so much. This has really been a very, very, very rich conversation. There's been lots and lots of engagement and conversation in the chat. Deborah, I know you were excited to bring Eve to our conversation, and I'm curious what you learned today and what you're taking away from our time together since you've known Eve's work longer than the rest of us.
Well, for me personally, it was fascinating, Eve, to hear some of those early stories, which I did not know about how you got involved in this in the first place. But also, it just struck me that a lot of the tools that we coaches use, specifically around listening and facilitating others to do what they need to do and to understand, you know, sort of what they're grappling with and how to make sense of it, those are coaching tools. And when you talked about getting the team members to talk to each other, I'm just starting to explore team coaching. And again, I'm seeing a lot of overlap between the two. So I've been just fascinated to listen to both the breadth of your experience, but the very practical common sense of, look, wake up. If you're going to have me here, use me, et cetera. So thank you so much for joining us. It was fascinating, as I knew it would be.
Thank you. Tracy, any closing thoughts on our conversation with Eve?
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating, Eve. I've loved hearing about the work and the breadth and the depth, and it's really kind of piqued my interest. I want to know more about how to engage organizations in those sort of structured, in-depth explorations of the problem space and the possibilities. That's really resonated with me. I know that you had some trainings and courses in the past, and I'd be very interested to hear if you're going to run anything like that again in the future, because a very, very fascinating topic.
I have none planned, but I can always design one for you, for your group.
Eve, thank you so much for making time in your day. I know you've got important family coming soon. I really, really appreciate your wisdom and advice and experience. Clearly, you have plowed this field very, very deeply over many, many years, and so generous of you to share your insights and thoughts with us. Thank you so much. Thank you again, Deborah, for bringing Eve to us. Thank you, everyone.